From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us. And here are the issues. As the coronavirus spreads, so does the fear and the economic damage. When will it be brought under control? The U.S. presidential race narrows to just two Democrats. One, of course, will take on President Trump this fall. Another election in Israel and a U.S. Taliban peace plan appears shaky just days after it was signed. Well, let's start with this coronavirus. The one story spreading around the world almost is spreading as quickly as the virus itself. Apparently, this is not just a health story, of course. It's an economic story as well. Airlines, cruise ships, manufacturing plants, supply chains, on and on and on, deeply affected by this. I guess the first question, and we'll start with you, Richard. When will this virus be brought under control, and at what cost?
It's a very good question. And the only answer I can give you at the moment is looking at what's happening in China. China has adopted draconian measures. And now we see that there's no new cases in this province of Hubei, with its capital Wuhan, after having been the center of the epidemic at the beginning. So I think it looks like at this very moment, from where it started, the virus has been contained. But now it's propagating all over the world. I just read this case in the UK, a woman who hadn't traveled and was not in contact with somebody who was sick. So there's still a lot we have to learn about the virus while it's still spreading, trying to figure out what form will it take and how does it go from one person to another.
In the latest numbers globally, more than 100,000 confirmed cases now, about 3,300 deaths. These figures from a database compiled by Johns Hopkins University, which is a very well regarded university here in the United States. And Tom, the same question I asked Richard. What is your sense based on everything you've read and people you've spoken with and so forth? When will this be brought under control, and again, at what cost?
Well, the cost will be in the tens of billions of dollars at a minimum, maybe even a few trillion dollars worldwide. And I think this will not be under control by the end of the year. I mean, the Centers for Disease Control in the United States have estimated that a vaccine for this virus probably will not be readily available for a year to 18 months in a best-case scenario. So I think this is, I wouldn't say it's open-ended. It will end at some point. But the notion that President Trump has said that it'll probably get better in April when the warm weather comes, scientists, they'd like the president to be right, but they don't think he is. I think we're talking months and maybe even a year or two.
Well, he's no doctor and he has no experience in these sorts of immunology issues and so forth. So it's perhaps more important to listen to what the actual experts say. And among their findings so far, I mean, opinions vary, but there seems to be kind of a general consensus that the death rate for this, again, the numbers tend to vary, but 2% to 2.5%, in other words, one of every 40 or 50 people who get this, which is very different than the flu, which is what the president has said. He said, well, it's just like the flu. Statistically, the number of people who perish from the flu is far lower than that in proportional terms. So one out of every 40 or 50, that's a rather alarming figure.
Yeah, it's a very heavy figure. And this is why it adds to the necessity of getting organized and getting ready. And even if the president is definitely not a specialist in this type of issue and crisis, he has looked at and listened to for advices, and at the moment he is fed into more confusion. And I mean, at the White House, the first briefing we attended, there is a mix of signals: be careful, wash your hands, don't touch your face, but don't worry about stuff. The president want to minimize the danger, but at a certain moment, his own scientific team, the doctors around him, the specialists, the experts, say you have to take all this seriously. The vice president himself, he sent the signal that every American could be tested, and now we don't have enough. We won't definitely have enough testing diagnostic kits to do this. So the population at the moment in the U.S., we have been receiving, even if we've heard the specialists from the CDCs with very clear indication on the state of the spreading of this virus, the political attitude towards this from the White House has created more confusion with the hesitation and the self-protection than anything else.
And on the issue of, long as Richard is bringing up the issue of politics here, Tom, it's a fair question. We're in the middle of a presidential campaign. We're going to go a little bit more in depth in just a minute. What about the political impact on the presidential race here? President Trump says everything is under control, all evidence to the contrary.
That's exactly right. The president is in serious damage control mode. His very first public statements about this were to talk about how 25,000 people in America die from the flu every year, suggesting, as you said earlier, Paul, that's a bigger problem than the virus. Of course, that's not the case. The president is trying to project leadership, but it's hard for him because he doesn't have details. He's not good at details, so I think it's probably wise for him to have turned this over to Vice President Pence, who was more prone to listen to the experts and more prone to be dealing with Democrats and others. These are the sorts of things that presidents always get more blame or credit than they often deserve, and this is an issue where the president will take some hits politically if this virus gets much, much worse. And if it's contained by summer, then that'll be better for him. But, I mean, he's very nervous because this is going to be a tough campaign, which we'll talk about. But he doesn't need to have something like this because people are scared. And he's trying to calm people down. But I must tell you, there are some in the White House who know there are going to be a lot more cases of the virus here. There are going to be many more deaths coming. Vice President Pence has talked euphemistically about more sad news to come. They don't want to talk too much about that because they know that that's not good for President Trump.
And there's a report by the investment bank Goldman Sachs, a big investment bank here in the United States, that kind of looking out to November, they say that this potentially could cost President Trump the election in November, depending, of course, on the severity and the length of this crisis. Well, let's talk about, in fact, big developments in the U.S. presidential race this week. On the Democratic side, it has really narrowed. I think it's fair to say now that it's down to just two people: former Vice President Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. He, of course, the senator from Vermont. What's interesting, and I'll start with you this time, Tom, Joe Biden, just even 2 weeks ago, seemed like his campaign might have been over. Now, all of a sudden, I think he's the front runner. What happened?
Well, some of our listeners here, longtime listeners, have probably heard me say this before because I say it a lot. I say it so much that my youngest son says, "Dad, I don't want to hear this anymore." But it is true. Overnight is a lifetime in politics. Anything can happen, and often it does. You're right. A week ago, I was having lunch with an old Republican friend of mine who said, "Well, Biden's going to win the South Carolina primary on the strength of the African-American vote, but he has no money. So what? He win in South Carolina, but that's the end of him. He has no money for television ads and everything." And then the next thing you know, there are 14 contests on the so-called Super Tuesday primaries. Biden won 10, Sanders won 4. And at the moment,
including, of course, the big one, California.
Right, yeah. Exactly right. So Biden has gone from dead in the water to leading, and there's another thing going on here. It's not just African-American voters. I think the biggest story of Biden's resuscitation, at least, and perhaps resurgence, is that it seems like the party is starting to clarify what's really important to them. And I think what the Democrats have decided is most important is getting rid of President Trump. So if they loved Senator Elizabeth Warren or if they love somebody else, they're looking for someone who can retire President Trump prematurely.
And Richard, on that point, there's kind of a phrase in American politics, I think Lyndon Johnson kind of coined the phrase, the big tent. You want as many people in your tent as possible. And if you look at sort of a who voted for Biden, some voting at the last minute, changing their mind, switching from Sanders and so forth, with the exception of so-called millennials, younger people who Sanders thought would come out for him in droves as usual, they stayed home. Younger people tend not to vote as much as older people. It looks like Biden got not just the black vote, but he got a lot of Hispanics and suburban women and just across the board. In other words, the big tent, he has a lot of different constituencies in his tent, which from a political standpoint, very impressive.
Yes. It's probably the reason why in the end, and very quickly, actually, we're seeing the end, but mid-March could be over. This race could be easily over. There are primaries on March 17 in Florida, in Illinois, in Ohio, Arizona, major states. And if this trend continues, former vice president is going to continue getting wins all over the place. His tent is big. What's surprising is that Bernie Sanders, from the start, insisted on the fact that he was bringing to the Democratic Party new voters, new enthusiastic voters. And indeed, as much as we have to acknowledge the success the former Vice President has had on Super Tuesday, his rallies have been much smaller and far less exciting than Bernie Sanders. And it's, as Tom underlined, there's a fatalistic reflex to say, okay, we want to beat Trump, so he's going to be our horse. But I'm not sure in the end it's a dynamic, positive choice that they're making. I'm not sure that the Bernie's supporters, the ones, the millennials, but also the ones that got involved, there's a lot of Latinos also, Hispanics in there, are going to jump on the, okay, well, we have to choose someone to be Trump. He's going to be the one and we're going to do it. I'm not sure that they were with Bernie for this reason. They wanted something more and Joe Biden is not offering it to them.
Is it too early then, as Richard seems to be suggesting, Tom, is it too early to be kind of talking about a Biden-Trump showdown?
I don't think it's too early. I mean, I would agree that Biden is not inevitable. As I've said before, you never know what's going to happen. He has a tendency for gaffes. As a Republican who was gearing up to deal with Biden says, you know, there's something about Joe Biden. He's gotten old and the spark plugs aren't fully connected to his engine. So they think they can make a lot of hay against Biden's tendency to say things or misspeak or gaffes or all of this kind of stuff. But it's interesting to note that at one point there was a sense that Bernie Sanders was going to get to the convention in Milwaukee with not enough delegates to be nominated, but leading the pack. And the sense was if there's a contested convention and the party moguls, the movers and shakers and brokers go to a smoke-filled room and take it away from Sanders, there will be a revolution in the party. That's not going to happen. I mean, the fact that Biden is ahead now is a result of the ballot, not as a result of smoke-filled room bargaining.
Okay. More to come on that, obviously, in the coming weeks and months. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Welcome back. There's been yet another election in Israel, the third one in the past year. Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, the longest serving prime minister, and Benny Gantz, his challenger. Netanyahu won this election, but the question is, and has always been, can he actually assemble a governing coalition there? That's been sort of the holdup that both of these men have faced. Can he do it this time, Richard?
Doesn't look like it. He claimed rightfully victory that time because his party, again, came in first, the Likud, but his coalition of hardline, smaller allies could not reach more than 58 seats. They need 61 in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, to be able to govern. And Benny Gantz, the opposition, and the other parties, definitely will not be able to form a parallel coalition. Benny Gantz, center-right, it's vague, but the other ones, the Arab Joint List, is the third biggest party now in Israel with 15 seats. And Benny Gantz said he was not going to count on these votes. So you're in a situation where, again, Israel doesn't look like it's going to have a stable government. And Benjamin Netanyahu needs to remain in power if he wants to avoid justice, which looks down at him in the middle of the month.
And speaking of justice, as Richard was just saying, it's really kind of an odd situation. Tom, Netanyahu, of course, faces trial just any day now on these charges of bribery and corruption. Now, to me, bribery and corruption sound like pretty serious issues, and yet there are a lot of voters who don't seem to be particularly bothered by that.
Well, but as things go, you don't want to have to deal with a trial like that in the middle of a governmental crisis here. And I think there's a certain number of Israelis here who have kind of, you get a sense that they're just kind of fed up with Netanyahu. Because of that, I think many in the various factions are reluctant to put to sign on with him, making the whole notion of forging a unity government or even a minority government harder. So I don't know what's going to happen. Well, it's quite possible, unless one of these scenarios find a handful of members of the Knesset to switch sides, it's not beyond possibility that you could have a fourth election this summer. So institutionally, it's chaos at the top of the governing situation in Israel, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be sorted out anytime soon.
Now, what if happened as this electoral standoff continues, possibility, as you say, of a fourth election? What happens if the sitting prime minister is convicted of these bribery charges and he's still the prime minister? Well, what happens?
Well, I think if he's still prime minister, the charges can be brought. They'll have to be postponed. So we're in a situation where at the moment he's the government. He's going to keep governing the country because there's no coalition unless there's a blue and white, which is Benny Gantz's party, and Likud coalition. But then Benny Gantz said he would never serve under Benjamin Netanyahu. Could there be a way within the Likud to say we're going to put aside Benjamin Netanyahu? It's hard to imagine at this moment. I also noticed that in the meantime, if the Israelis seem to be divided on everything, they seem to agree on the fate of the Palestinian territories. Benny Gantz and Benjamin Netanyahu agree on the solution brought forward by the Americans, Jared Kushner, the present son-in-law, with his plan in the end, which implies annexation of the Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories. Even this week, Jared Kushner has talked to senators saying if the Palestinians are not ready to negotiate on what we suggested, we're going to go ahead and recognize the annexation of these Israeli settlements. So while there's political instability in Israel, the Palestinians are the major loser in this reality.
Well, speaking of peace plans, we've got to move on here. We've got that peace plan, which does not appear to be going anywhere. Meantime, another peace plan, this one signed between the United States and Taliban, ostensibly aimed at ending what has been an 18-year war between the U.S. and the Taliban ever since the United States invaded Afghanistan after the terror attacks on New York and Washington in 2001, an 18-year war. But even that peace plan signed again just a couple of days ago, Tom, looks shaky already.
Yes, U.S. Military forces have launched strikes against Taliban, who they said was threatening military and coalition forces there. There's been a new wave of bombings, political suicide bombings in the area. And now both sides are saying, well, we didn't say the violence would have to stop. We agreed to reduce violence as a goodwill gesture. But that was going to be difficult, at least from a distance. The so-called deal in Afghanistan with the Taliban seems to have crumbled before it really got underway. I mean, it's not that many days ago that President Trump got on the phone and spoke for the first time in 18 years with the leader of the Taliban. They both said all the right things, and yet violence continues. So, I mean, I think Afghanistan has, for centuries, has been a problem for great powers who thought they could impose their will. The British, the Soviets. Now the Americans are learning. And President Trump really wants to get out of Afghanistan. And President Trump is learning that it's harder to work your will and easier said than done to do what you want to do and get your troops out of there, which he really wants to see troops come home by the election.
Well, they don't call Afghanistan the graveyard of empires for nothing. But when, you know, it seems to me that we're going to have, just my view here, is that we're going to have troops in Afghanistan for a very long time, and even just a token force. And there are some people who say, and just to quickly, Richard, give me your view, I mean, the United States has had troops in Germany for 75 years, we've been in Korea for about 70 years now, and perhaps one way of looking at it is that they have a kind of a, at least some say, a stabilizing influence, and in Korea, certainly a tripwire in the event of trouble there. Is there anything so bad about just maintaining a small force in Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's, we kind of understood after the Second World War and the Korean War that the American forces were necessary. In this very case, it looks more, because fundamentally the reason why the Americans were on the ground was to fight Al-Qaeda after 9/11. Our listeners have to know and understand that not only the president wants to bring back the soldiers, but the American people are not interested in keeping soldiers over there. So we can have special forces on the ground to fight. The Americans can have special forces on the ground to fight extremists here and there. But in the end, the president doesn't care about appearances, and it's only appearances that justify at the moment American forces on the ground. Appearances, the fate of women, their place in society, their role, the position of ethnic minorities trying to avoid being overwhelmed by the Pashtuns, the central government, the appearance of credibility in a very corrupt environment. All these appearances, it's the only reason why we keep soldiers, the Americans keep soldiers there, because the Taliban are not anymore the terrorists they were in the past, but the nationalist forces who are trying to kick out the foreigners in their land. So in the end, I do not see how the president can lose on this. The agreement, the peace agreement is weak, is not clear, but in the end, he's going to win because nobody in the U.S. is really seriously fighting to keep soldiers over there.
All right, we're going to have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Tom DeFrank, his contributing editor to National Journal, and Richard LaTendresse, he's correspondent here in Washington for TV8 Nouvelles Canada. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis. Thanks very much for joining us.